Today's episode of Beyond the Mask is presented by the team at CRNA Financial Planning. Get a free consultation today to be guided through the complexities of investing and financial planning. Just visit crnafinancialplanning.com. Beyond the Mask is also sponsored by crnaeducation.com. CRNAs, you can get the CE credits you need by just going to crnaeducation.com. They have over 100 AANA prior approved credits, all four core CPC modules, and even over 40 pharmacology credits. No subscriptions, it's all online and mobile friendly. Just go to crnaeducation.com. And don't forget, listening to our podcast can earn you Class B credits. For more information on how you can submit them, check out our CE credit tab on our website, beyondthemaskpodcast.com. Welcome to Beyond the Mask, innovation and opportunities for CRNAs and advanced practice nurses, with certified financial planner Jeremy Stanley and CRNA Sharon Pierce. Jeremy Stanley has worked with CRNAs for more than 23 years, and Sharon Pierce is a former president of the AANA and the NCANA. Join us as we leave the operating room and learn the latest in the CRNA and advanced practice nurse industries. Beyond the Mask starts in 10, 9, 8, 7.
Hey, Sharon, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Well, I'm doing great. You know, lovely day here in the Carolinas. What is it? A blistery, 30 degrees today? And looking forward to the sun and the weather that's coming in about 3 months.
Yeah, well, I just got back from the sun. The Fab Four were in Phoenix having a long weekend, it was 60-some degrees there.
Oh, wow. Good for you. Yeah, I'm looking forward to those days again.
Yeah, it was very nice. We stayed at Jackie's house there, Jackie Roll's house, and she has a hot tub outside, and so we would sit out in the hot tub in the evening. Now it got cold at night, so we would run out to the hot tub and then run back into the house, but we had a great time.
And I know there was no alcohol involved to keep you warm on the inside, right?
Not as much as there used to be. We were kind of making fun of ourselves because her entire refrigerator was full of wine when we got there, and it was still pretty full when we left. So we're finding that we can't quite consume as much as we used to, say, 23 years ago when we first all started being friends.
Yeah, 23 years will make you slow down a little bit.
So. Yes, it will.
Well, I think we've got another great show today and a wonderful guest. And Sharon, you want to tell who our guest is today?
Absolutely. I would love to. Most people know Deborah Diaz, and I've known Deborah for, good Lord, I'm not even sure how long I've known Deborah, but Deborah will tell a little bit more about herself in a moment. She's in Florida, where it is probably a lot warmer than we are, though the way this weather is lately, who knows if that's the case. But Deborah has been active in the military, and, you know, military CRNAs are really a backbone of our profession, and neither you or I have served in the military, so we thought this would be a good opportunity for us to learn a little bit more about it. So, Deborah, given that, why don't you introduce yourself, tell a little bit about yourself, and kick off our topic for us today.
Thank you so much. I am really excited to be here, and I want to say hi from all our Florida CRNAs who are about losing their minds because the weather went down to 30 degrees. And I am here in Tallahassee because FANA has CRNA Day tomorrow. And so I am advocating for our House Bill 257, which is for full practice authority. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, I always have to put in a plug for FANA and for Region 7. And so a little bit about myself. I have been a CRNA since 1994. That way you don't have to do the math. You could just say what year it is.
Deb, it's okay. I like doing the math.
I'm sure you do. But I have been an RN 1976. Again, I don't want to do the math. I'm very proud of the fact that I have been a nurse for a long time. Some people don't like to, you know, talk about all the years, but I think that that's what makes me able to look at the growth that we have made. And I think that having a historical background, because I'm now one of those historical background people, enables me to tell people how far we have come. I was commissioned in the military as a U.S. Navy, go Navy, Nurse Corps officer in 1992. And so I served 24 years, both in the active duty component and the reserves. I was fortunate enough to do duty on three aircraft carriers and have been deployed overseas. Just loved my 24 years in the Navy.
Well, Deb, first and foremost, as always, we thank you for your service and all you've done for our country in the Navy. And, you know, obviously you're still doing stuff for the CRNA profession, as you've been very active on that front as well. So let's kind of talk about your responsibilities as a naval officer. And how was that different than being a civilian CRNA?
Well, it's not, as they say, a 9-to-5 job. It's a 24/7, 365. And being a Navy CRNA, you have to go along two tracks. You have to go along your leadership and military track, as well as your profession, what they call your NOBC, that's what the Navy hired you for, is to be a CRNA. But oh no, there's more, folks. You have to be able to lead the people that are in your department and in your area. And that involves not just doing your job, but also the corpsmen that you work for, or with, I should say. Sometimes I feel like I work for them because they do such an outstanding job, and I'm very partial to the Navy corpsmen. And then you have to do whatever it entails depending on where you are. For example, when I was crossing deck from one carrier to another, I had to make sure that my OR was fully stocked and ready for any occasion or something bad that happens. I like to say any occasion because it sounds like we're having fun. But for any occasion, as we went Pearl Harbor back to Yokosuka, Japan. So you have to make sure that you know what equipment you need. You have to direct the surgical tech that you have. Plus, the ship's nurse has to know what you need because they are not in the OR. So it's interesting. Supply officer, pre-op nurse, intra-op nurse, and then post-op. You have to do PACU as well.
So, Deb, let me ask you this. You alluded to the fact that they really stress leadership. I assume they train you for that. So why don't you tell us about some of the training that you receive as a naval officer? I think that's really important.
Oh, absolutely. Well, when you start as an ensign, you're considered a junior officer. And the Navy has kind of a different view than, say, the Army or the Air Force. You're considered a junior officer all the way through to being a lieutenant commander, which is in 04. That would be the same as a major in the Air Force or the Army. And they consider that same rank as a field grade officer going on to senior officer. So that is kind of a middle grade, that you're not young and you're not old. So you start getting leadership training where you do go to classes, you meet with senior officers, you get mentored by senior officers as you perform every duty that you have to do. So I started when I was a lieutenant as a supply officer. So I needed to make sure that the corpsmen that were under me, you know, had to lead them, had to make sure that I guided them how to not only do their jobs, but how they can make rank. Because making rank is also for them how they can move up in the enlisted corps. So one of the things that you learn is not just how to do your job again, but how to help them so that each of their evaluations will put them in the best light possible. And then if you have people that are kind of marginal, which none of my corpsmen were ever marginal, but how you can help them get to where they're motivated about their jobs, how they can be encouraged to be educated, because most of them have high school education. And so you want to be able to get them to see that there are many things that they can do.
So Deb, I know that you've served your state. You've been president of FANA. You've served on the AANA board. You've served on committees. How did what you have learned in your leadership from the military translate and was helpful to your leadership in these positions that you've held within the nurse anesthesia profession?
Well, that's a great question. And I am very comfortable and confident that what I learned in the military helped me translate to being on the boards of state and national levels, because it's all about relationships and learning how to bring out the best in everybody. And my philosophy has always been servant relationships and team relationships. How do you, I don't think that you need to know everything, but I think that you need to utilize and leverage people's talents so that they can move forward. And then while you may not know everything, you know people who do. So I like to read Malcolm Gladwell, and he talks about the tipping point and being a connector. And I am a connector. I know who knows what, and I put people together that can move forward and bring our profession forward.
Yeah, and I think those are really, really good points, Deb. And I want to come back to some of the training in just a minute that you received in the military and how that helped you. But how did your nurse anesthesia program prepare you for being a military CRNA?
Well, my program was a civilian program. When we had the first Gulf War, a lot of the CRNAs left the military afterwards. And what happened was, is they knew they were going to be short. And the Navy nurse anesthesia program only had 14 or 15 slots. So they knew they were going to need to have more in the pipeline. So what I did was a full-time out-of-service training. So in reality, my program, which had just turned into a master's program, didn't really touch that much on leadership. I had to learn that from, well, first of all, I was a nurse in ICU for 16 years. So I learned a lot of leadership from that point. Then when I got into officer, they called it back then, officer indoctrination school. So right from the beginning, I went to 3 months of leadership classes and learning how to be an officer in the Navy. The Navy called it knife and fork. You would learn how to use your knife and fork. So I went through 3 months of classes, training, physical training, and again, all the policies that I would need to get started and how I can implement those policies and how I can get the enlisted people that I was working with getting them on board and yay about the Navy. Although I've got to say, they were all gung-ho to begin with.
Attention all certified nurse anesthetists. Are you in need of a reliable and quality continuing education option? Well, look no further than CRNAeducation.com. We are an NBCRNA-recognized provider, offering all four core CPC modules to meet your certification requirements. You can choose from more than 100 AANA prior-approved Class A CE credits, with 43 articles covering a wide range of anesthesia topics. Need pharmacology CE credits? Well, we've got you covered there as well, with over 40 pharmacology CE credits available. All credits are completed online and are mobile friendly. Choose articles worth 1, 2, or 3 credits. There's no subscriptions, no hidden fees, just the CE credits you need when you need them. Owned by CRNAs since 2011, you can trust in our commitment to your education. And customer service is always a quick email or phone call or even text away. To sign up and find out more about our education options, visit CRNAeducation.com, your partner in continuing education. That's CRNAeducation.com.
Deb, what ships can CRNAs now serve on? I know that's changed over the years, and I know that was something used to be women couldn't serve on some ships, so that just encompassed female CRNA. So give us a little bit of background on that.
Well, it's interesting you said that. I first served on the aircraft carrier, the USS Kennedy, and that was integrated. And nowadays, when they say integrated, they mean male and female. Mm-hmm. Then I went to Japan and had to take the carrier, the USS Independence. It was not integrated. So there was me as a female and one of the flight surgeons for the air wing, that we were the only two females on a ship that, when it was full complement, was 5,500 people. So it was two females. So they knew where I was at all times. My activities were reported to the XO, the executive officer, who is second in command, at all times.
Interesting. So what kind of cases did you do on these aircraft carriers?
Well, just to answer the other part of the question, which I forgot, CRNAs can also serve on LHAs and LHDs, which are transport ships, and they transport Marines, because as the Marines like to say, the Navy is their transportation.
Yes, I've heard that.
Right. And they're our color guard. So we get, it's a mutual symbiotic relationship.
Yeah.
So the cases that we would do once we were underway had to be emergency cases, right? Because once we got to a point of no return where we were in the middle of where we could not evac any personnel, we had to make sure that this, whatever the case was absolutely necessary. And then once we got back and we were closer, it seemed like the last week we did a ton of vasectomies. So I found that interesting and kind of on the hilarious side. But
that makes total sense.
It did. But what we did was appendectomies. If somebody had a hernia that was incarcerated, we had, now this was an interesting case, somebody on the flight deck from the air department swallowed her tongue ring, but really she aspirated her tongue ring.
Oh my gosh.
And oh, she was in so much trouble because first of all, you're not supposed to have them. Second of all, we were underway and we had to delay. Now, when you go out with a carrier group, you don't just go out with an aircraft carrier. You have all of the defense of that aircraft carrier, which are, you know, it's like a battle group going out. So we had to delay going forward because of this case that we were going to do. And so it had to be a general anesthetic. So, of course, the Admiral of the Seventh Fleet knew about it. And he was so angry because the CO of the aircraft carrier had to tell him, well, sir, we have to halt our forward movement because we need to make sure that we can evacuate this person because we're coming into the point of no return.
Wow.
So it was a very quick case. I intubated her. They plucked out the tongue stud, and all was right with the world except for her.
Wow. Yeah, I'm sure she was in deep sticky something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then we had somebody that had a bolus of chicken that we had to pick at for 2 hours trying to get it because he couldn't with all the saliva that he was making. And those were the kind of cases, but it wasn't wartime then. So I feel sometimes that because I wasn't there in wartime on the ship, it made me feel lacking because I felt like that's what I trained for and I wasn't there.
Well, you've got to take care of your own, Deb. So you were taking care of the people on your ship, which is important. It's kind of like the oxygen mask thing. You've got to put it on yourself first. So if you weren't taking care of our military might, then there would be problems. So in my mind, it's no less. You're just not seeing people's arms and legs blowed off. So in my mind, that could be a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I did spend 2 years in Landstuhl. And in Landstuhl, and this was, as you can call me Colonel Settner, alluded to when she was testifying, that it was amazing to me how we would get the casualties from Iraq and Afghanistan to Landstuhl, sometimes within 24 hours of their injury. And
wow.
So what they would do is they would do their polytrauma surgery and then put them on the plane, and that's where they recovered them. Then they would come to us, and we would do whatever they needed, whatever definitive treatment they needed, within 24 hours of them being injured. So once we would get the evac planes into Ramstein, they would drive them up the hill and bring them to us, and we would do whatever they needed to have done until they went to CONUS, which was, depending on what service they were, whether they went to Bethesda. At that time, it was the Naval Hospital. And then the Army would go to Walter Reed. But now they're combined. And so it's called Walter Reed National Medical Center, Military Medical Center at Bethesda.
So for us non-military people, and I know just a little bit because Jerry Hogan, whom you also know, all of this, they're evacuated to Germany, either Ramstein and then to you at Landstuhl. Yes. You know, my understanding is our trauma care in the United States was patterned after the military because back in the Vietnam War, what they found out is you had a better chance of surviving on the battlefield, getting injured in Vietnam than you did having an accident on the streets and highways of the United States. Because I can tell you, my neighbor owned the funeral home in my small hometown, and he remembers they just used to get the hearse. And if somebody had an accident, they just threw them in the back of the hearse and took them to the hospital because we didn't have real care. We didn't have ambulances. We didn't have trained people back then. And it's what, the golden hour? If you get to them within the first hour, they're more likely to survive. And so our whole idea of trauma care came from the military. And you just kind of said, you see these people within 24 hours of injury, they're already evacuated from the military site and already in Germany.
Right. And so Ramstein is the Air Force base where they land. And so then they get them on the buses, and it's not like you're sitting up on the bus. These buses are fitted for the patients that they're lying flat. And they bring ICU patients to us as well. I was there as an individual augmentee, and I had a roommate who was active duty, and she was a pulmonologist. So sometimes she would go and do lung flights, is what they call them, and bring us back these patients that were already intubated in the field by the corpsman or the medics, and they would bring them to us in 24 hours and less than. Burns, one of my last patients, which was very dramatic for me, was a patient that had a refueling accident, and it was in Bagram, and they just loaded him on, did whatever they had to do there, and loaded him on and did and brought him to us. Just as he got off the plane in Ramstein, put him on the bus, brought him up to us, wheeled him into my OR, and at that time, the burn unit of the people that came from San Antonio were coming down the hallway. It was pretty impressive. I did not know what race this man was because he was so badly burnt.
Wow.
Now, I found out he didn't make it, and I didn't think he was going to, but he was, I mean, it's just really hard to talk about. But he was just burnt, and then on the anterior surface, and then when we rolled him over, you could see just a little patch of skin, and I found out then that he was African American. Because we didn't have time. We just heard what it was that was going on. We put him on the OR table, and of course, you don't use any volatile agents, and thank God for propofol, you know, and then the burn team came, and this was also what is impressive is it's a group of young men and women. I mean, I'm talking 19, 20 years old that are on the burn team, and they come with their physician, the burn physician. They are all hopped up on being young and energy drinks.
Oh my God, hopped up.
And they're like buzzing. They're buzzing, you know. And then we do the escharotomy. We do what we have to do. They send the patient to ICU. And then they go to bed so that they can be alert and ready to take the patient back to San Antonio. And that patient maybe was 48 hours once they get into San Antonio from the point of injury. I'm just so impressed with that.
What other kinds of cases did you see? You've alluded to burns, I'm sure, combat injuries.
We would see multiple amputees. I had a patient that had no sternum.
Oh my.
That his ribs were wired together and he had no sternum.
Wow.
So once I started the case and they took his dressing off, which was a wound vac, his heart is right there, just right there. I just have no idea what they were going to fashion a sternum for him. I don't know if he survived because unfortunately what happens with us as anesthesia personnel, we don't really have follow-up care. And then also in Landstuhl, they're going to different hospitals, different cities. So we don't know what happens, you know? And I just, sometimes for me, it was better just to be ignorant and think, well, they all survived. I just know this last gentleman I had didn't. He was just, he made it an indelible mark on my memory.
Just some things you cannot forget, for sure. Deb, what is an embedded training team?
So I was on an embedded training team. Unfortunately, my orders got canceled, but I went to Fort Polk, Louisiana, which is an Army base, which was a Navy appreciation tour. So what you did was you had to do combat training just like the combatants, and I had to get qualified on an M4, on a 9mm pistol, and we went into an area for live fire that was called Inside the Box. And so when you're in the box, it's live fire training. And so we did urban warfare training, and we did reconnaissance. I was the gunner for a while in a Humvee, and then we had to learn how to do MRAPs, work in MRAPs, where you have a number of personnel inside, and then the back of the truck comes down, and they all come running out with their weapons on hot, which is live fire. It was because we were going to embed in the Afghanistan Army's hospital to help with teaching the Afghan anesthesiologists how to do anesthesia with this type of cases. And then our orders got canceled. And then about 3 weeks later, insurgents rushed the hospital I was going to be in. And I saw people that were climbing out of the ORs, because they had windows, onto the ledges, because the Taliban was using, you know, they were taking hostages and killing people in the ORs. So they had developed a team where if you were in an OR, you always had one person that had their weapon on hot and were able to fire at any time. Meanwhile, you're doing anesthesia. And the surgeon is operating, and you have to be ready for somebody to storm your OR.
Beyond the Mask is made possible by the team at CRNA Financial Planning. With almost two decades of experience, the firm guides CRNAs through the complexities of investing and financial planning. Schedule a free consultation today by calling 855-304-3748 or go online to crnafinancialplanning.com.
Wow, so you're armed and dangerous and courage under fire. I was definitely armed and dangerous. Now, did you carry a weapon when you were in this particular environment in the OR?
I carried two.
Well, excuse me. I didn't carry one, ma'am. I carried two. Oh, yeah.
I had a 9mm. And then I had an M4, wow. Which they used the M4 over the M16 because it was a shorter barrel. So when you're in tight quarters, you don't have to worry about the buttstock.
Ah, well, there you have it. You've given us a lot of scenarios here. So what did you gain from your military service, do you think, Deb?
All of the males in my family have been in the military. And so when I was younger, you could not be in combat. You were relegated to being a nurse, being behind the lines. And so all of that has changed with understanding trauma and how it's so important to get to whomever is injured. So I gained a sense and appreciation for how science and trauma care has advanced. Then the other thing that I have gained is the ability to lead. You know, I know you love Simon Sinek, and it's,
yes,
you know,
I do.
Yeah, right. And so that book, I loved what a Start With Why, but I really appreciated Leaders Eat Last. So I have always been, well, you know, going into nursing, you have an appreciation to be a caregiver. You know, it's not that you come in for 2 seconds and write your orders as physicians do and leave. You're actually the one that is there with the patient. And so it was natural for me to go from ICU to anesthesia because we're still clinical. And so I loved that part of being clinical and doing anesthesia, where very few people have the privilege to take care of the people that I was privileged to take care of. So leadership, caring for the brave men and women, and I'm talking brave men and women that have been blown up, have, you know, had parts of their body taken from them, and knowing that I made a difference in their life, in their care, you know, and sometimes, you know, just a gentle word here and there to make them feel comfortable. You know, I had a case where I was on call and there were 4 guys that were having washouts done. And so they were getting stacked one after another. And I knew that something was not right because usually they're gregarious, they're insulting each other, they're having a good time no matter what. And it seems, that seems weird. But this day, they were all very sullen. And it was months after that I heard on TV, when I saw their faces on the national news, that they had lost their lieutenant because of friendly fire, and he died.
Jeez. Well, Deb, as we kind of wrap up and conclude here, is there anything you would like to conclude on and get across to our listeners?
Well, I think that one of the most important things to me is how we as CRNAs always are of service to the community. Wherever we work, I worked also in the county hospital in Miami, and we did liver transplants and kidney transplants. And, you know, we were of service in the civilian sector. You know, I was always, it was my community hospital because I grew up near there. And so always being of service to me is like the most important value that I have and the most important action. So you take it to the military, and to me, it's one of the highest levels of service that you can give. And then also to be able to give back to the profession that has given so much to me. I cannot believe that I actually get paid to do what I do. And then to do it at the level that I'm allowed to do it. And then it just goes on and on. And being able to teach and make a difference for the future of our profession, and then serving on the board, to me, it was just, I've gotten so much from this profession. There's very little that I've given back, but I keep trying.
Wow. I mean, I think that's a great statement, Deb. I think us on the outside view that a little bit differently. We feel like you've been one of the ones that have given back a lot, kind of like Sharon. You've given your time, you've given your treasure, and you've given your talent. And we want to thank you for that. Thank you for your service in the military. Thank you for the service to all the CRNAs out there and all you continue to do in this great and wonderful profession that we all benefit from.
It's been my privilege to be able to give back. It's been my privilege to be a CRNA along with people like the Fab Four and Miss Pierce over there, Dr. Pierce. And it's absolutely, I mean, I get energized by the people that I serve with.
I can second that.
Yes.
I do too. I understand that sentiment.
Well, again, Sharon, as we wrap up here, I don't think we could wrap on any better comments than what you two have just made. And we want to thank our listeners for listening to Beyond the Mask with Jeremy Stanley and
Sharon Pierce.
Sharon, if they like our show and want to help us grow, what can they do to help us grow?
Well, the best way to help us to grow is to leave us a review, tell all your friends, share it on social media, but make the review
positive. We all know there's way too much negativity in this world.
Absolutely. We're in the top 50 medical podcast in the country, on our way to number one,
just like we are in the CRNA community. And thank you to our listeners and all the folks out there that have supported us throughout the years. You've made us number one in the CRNA community, and we're very, very appreciative of that. So Sharon, until next time.
It's a wrap.
Hi, this is Jackie Rolls, president of the International Federation of Nurse Anesthetists and president and founder of Our Hearts, Your Hands, a global anesthesia support community that takes donations to allow nurse anesthetists in low and middle income countries to go to educational programs, buy equipment, or textbooks. Your donations are tax deductible, and we would appreciate your support.
Be sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and anywhere you like to listen to shows. Also, be sure to check out BeyondTheMaskPodcast.com. Each episode is posted there with a corresponding blog post, and we timestamp important parts of the episode to help you quickly get to the content you're looking for. Also, check out the special series section on the site. You can follow along and catch up on the CRNA History Series, episodes specifically about political conversations in the industry, or try the CRNA Personal Finance Series. It's all on BeyondTheMaskPodcast.com. And if you have a question for the show or want to be a guest or even suggest a particular topic, fill out the contact form on the site or send an email directly to us at info@BeyondTheMaskPodcast.com. And lastly, let's take the conversation social. Check out our Beyond the Mask podcast Facebook page and Facebook group.